If you have questions, please line up by the microphone, since the internet's been flaky. I will first ask the panel. A number of you interacted with these NGOs, and often these were small organizations without IT security expertise. How did you balance the roles of researcher and probably being the person or people they'd reach out to if they had a security issue? Did that prove challenging? Did you run into that issue?
So in my case, not so much. The main interaction was for them to share data with us, because we focused on the reconnaissance phase. We did not have to deal with compromised systems, for example. So it was mainly data sharing.
I think in my interactions with NGOs and individuals, because the study was of a different nature, kind of looking at attacks as they came rather than an analysis of 4 years of data, the issues that I kind of faced were, or the challenges that I faced were, well, so say I see one instance of an attack, and just from that single instance, you might not be able to trace it back to an actor or a specific type of technology, but with additional observation, you could perhaps link interesting things together. And it's kind of attention. Like if you see people getting attacked, obviously you have to take steps to take down that command and control infrastructure if possible. If this is hosted on like VPS providers, send complaints and get the domain names or the IP addresses suspended. But there's also a tension as well. Like you want this to be developed. You want your story to be developed well enough so that you can give compelling warnings to people. Like just saying, oh, people are sending out malware, don't open attachments, versus building this entire story of, oh, look, this is the government targeting you guys, there could be serious consequences. And I think people pay more attention if there's like a compelling story around that. So there's definitely the tension of needing to map this out to tell a compelling story, but also you want to take stuff down so that people aren't getting owned and suffering these negative consequences.
In our study, part of the work that we do, it includes fieldwork and interviews with the organizations. So as a result, we get to interact directly with them and see the sort of attacks that are coming in. And a large part of this is to work on education as well. So while we do sometimes help with that sort of cleanup and technical assistance in the process of getting samples, especially in the Tibetan community, they have a history of antivirus companies in particular, researchers coming in, scraping them for data, and then never contributing anything back to the community. So what we try to do is meet people and talk to people face to face and understand what their threat models are like, what they're actually dealing with day to day. And we do the analysis of the malware and we do the academic research, but we also help with education to teach people how to defend themselves against these attacks and build up their own technical knowledge in that community.
Hi, Grant Hill from UC Berkeley. So 2 years ago, Google announced that it deployed infrastructure to detect state-sponsored attacks and warn users against them. I was wondering if any of your users had seen these sorts of warnings and if you had been in touch with Google.
So in my case, they did not.
So in my case, I was contacted by a number of individuals and groups who were like, oh my god, I see a warning in my account. Like, what does it mean? If you're familiar with the warning, it says just kind of like a yellow box at the top. We believe that state-sponsored attackers may be trying to compromise your account or your computer. Click here to learn more. And there's no real details. Like when people talk to me about this, they're really nervous about like that there's no details or context surrounding the warning. Like they don't know whether it was something that recently happened or whether it was something that was 6 months ago, whether it was something which they've already forwarded to me and taken care of, or whether it's something they missed. I think it's good to let people know about this, but the non-specificity of the warning, the lack of details, make people very nervous and limit the stuff that I can tell them. Like, well, maybe the warning was about this thing that you received, or I don't know, maybe it's something else.
Some of the people that we work with kind of laugh at it a little bit as a too little too late award, where they're like, yeah, clearly I'm getting state-sponsored attacks. Thanks for noticing, Google. It's because of the lack of information that comes along with it that it makes it not particularly useful, because those sorts of people already are aware that they're coming under heavy attack in our case.
Okay, thanks.
Emily Gretz with University of Michigan. Most applicably for the first paper, but just generally, did you guys notice anything about how the government actions stand up against the laws in the region? Like, are they breaking them and then just trying to go unnoticed, or just doing legal and really sketchy things?
Well, in some cases, it does appear that the government is breaking the law. For example, there's a recent case in Bahrain where a number of lawyers were targeted with this spyware, and it so there's specific provisions in Bahraini law which would make this type of surveillance on lawyers generally illegal. So it does appear in some cases that yes, the law is being broken by the governments, and they, you know, they are, at least in the case of Bahrain, they do appear to be trying to be very stealthy about it. Also in the UAE, one of the things we noticed was that the government apparently switched away from this kind of like flashy, easily attributable, you know, hacking team, FinFisher stuff, and started using more off-the-shelf type malware, where when you see it, it's not automatic, you don't automatically know it's the government, because these types of products are more generally available. So I think the model's definitely, you know, be as covert as possible, and I do think that in some cases there has been laws that have been broken. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, Tad Book from Rice. I was curious if any of you or the people you worked with had tried responding to any of these emails, and if so, do you learn more about the attackers from responses?
So in my case, we tried it once. The attacker sent an Android malware to my volunteer, and I asked my volunteer to ask the attacker whether he... it was a bit more complicated than that. The attacker implied that the malware had been sent from an Android phone and that the user should open it on an Android phone. So I told my volunteer to reply and say that he was using an iPhone, but he did not get any reply from that.
We did something similar. It was actually the Cheng Li email. The recipient replied saying, thank you very much for the information, but I opened it up and nothing happened. Maybe it has to do with the fact that I'm running a Mac, I don't know. Uh-huh. And then there was a follow-up email with Mac-specific malware that came in afterwards.
Very good, thank you.
Vernon Paxson from Berkeley. I have a question for Seth, I found your presentation really interesting in this notion of developing a metric. What seems still challenging, though, is how to establish that the metric is sort of sound and principled. And, you know, for one thing, it could be that your number five targeting is just way, way better than the four. Or just a bit better, and the four is way better than the three, and so forth. And same on the technical end. There's really, I didn't gather from your presentation, a basis for A, these things ought to have these numeric values, and then B, it makes sense to multiply. I'm not looking to discourage the work, but actually just the opposite. I think that it's stimulating to start talking about this, but I think there's a lot still to be done in order. What do we want with the metric? We want it to be like predictive or have explanatory power. And so that a number, right now, I don't know whether your sixes really are worse than your fives, because I don't know whether you've got the weighting right or whether multiplying is what makes sense. That then also brings up how incredibly handy it would be to have a corpus of successful attacks. So we could look and say, well, gee, you know, let's do the statistical test. You know, if it's targeted thusly and it's this technically sophisticated, it has this probability of success and the like. And there's, I think, a lot of work to do there. So I have two sort of questions. There's a specific one responding to the development of the metric. And then a broader one, which I think is really the challenge for this work, which is because we encountered this on the Bill's work when we were putting it out for peer review, that our research community struggles to say, oh, this is principled science, even though I think the work is very important. And I think they struggle with that because it's so fledgling. And so I'm interested in other thoughts on, okay, how do we pull in the community, the academic research community, to say, this is really substantive stuff to work on, and here's a roadmap.
Okay, well, you're absolutely right about the limitations of the metric there. It is brand new, and we don't have any experience with running it on data sets outside of our own. So we're hoping to see that more with other data sets and start to make refinements, looking at the possibility of changing it from the arbitrary decision of the multiplier. The main reason for that was just because CVSS uses that sort of a model, and it's not scientifically precise either, perhaps, but it's a good first step. And if we can find ways of doing alternate methods of statistical weighting on the two factors based on what we actually see in practice, then that would be great. And we're hoping to do continual refinements in that way. One thing that we're doing is when the study is released in October, we're going to be publishing our data sets, and everything is going to be, the TTI on everything is going to be calculated, as well as the content coding as well. So the codes applicable to each of the emails in the data set are going to be there. And so if maybe if we could work towards finding a way to do similar coding from other data sets, we could use combined data from different recipients, different types of recipients, to come up with better ways of improving the metric.
Okay, and then there is this broader question of engaging the community. In fact, if I were to speculate, had only one of those three papers been submitted, we wouldn't be here, because they're viewed as, this is what I gather, and I'm talking not only from feedback from our shepherd and the discussions and so forth, but also how our submission to Oakland, of pretty much exactly the same paper, was treated, and I don't really blame the PCs per se. I mean, I don't think they were like being dumb or anything. But I think that the bridging this gap, I really would love to have a dialogue about. Okay, how do we turn this into something that is academically respectable, and we don't get reviews that are essentially, that would be a cool blog post. Why don't you do that? Which is more or less what the some of the peer review responds to it is. Do you have thoughts on that? So does it make sense the way I'm framing it?
I think I'm following you.
This would, by the way, be a good discussion for the 9:30 Birds of a Feather session.
So if I may comment,
yeah, of course.
I think one of the problems with the studies that we've done so far is that they are very, by definition, a target attack is targeted, so
they're singular.
They're very specific, and it's hard to generalize. And another problem is that they are low volume. So in my case, I was lucky that the data set I was analyzing was fairly big, but I think for the other two papers, it might have been also problematic to, have the reviewers argue that they were so small that they were even less representative.
I hear you on that.
So I'm not quite sure, but I would think that perhaps moving towards the monitoring, the attack attribution, from a technical perspective, not necessarily by cause and effect relationship, like Bill's paper did, try to automate those steps, and perhaps also look at defenses would make this type of work more acceptable for the academic community.
One thing that we did in the specification of the TTI metric was clear descriptions of where the cutoffs for each step and value is. So even if, say we find that the multiplier doesn't work in context outside of, say, the Tibetan community, the breakoff points are still clearly specified for how to partition the samples into different levels. And even if that gets combined with the qualitative coding and used in a different way, that sort of separation into different bins, I think, is still pretty useful.
Yeah, I would agree. In fact, when you were starting it and you said, oh, we've got these five numbers, I thought, oh, yeah, right. And how are you going to decide which number? And I really liked that I knew once you presented it, okay, this is procedurally, unambiguously the right number, you know, by doing this assessment. Thanks.
Thank you.
Rima Tanash, Rice University. Question for Bill. Was there a particular reason for you guys focusing on Bahrain, Syria, and United Emirates? And did you guys look into Saudi Arabia and Egypt, given all the recent events? And my other question is, you mentioned that you went to school in Bahrain, and given this work, were you ever felt threatened or maybe in risk? I'm not sure if you have family there or so. Thank you.
Well, I'll answer your second question first. So I graduated from high school in 2005, I guess. So I haven't lived in Bahrain for quite a while now. I don't think I'd have trouble going back there. I wouldn't feel at risk if I was there. I don't still have family there, which is good. I do still have friends there, which, you know, I keep in contact with them, and they're kind of you know, maintaining their distance. Like, yeah, don't look me up, don't visit me. Like, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want them to be on to me, right? So to your first question, mainly I first started looking at Bahrain just because that was the area I was working on in my activism. And then, you know, in response to all this publicity about the initial work, some people in the UAE reached out to me and were like, hey, I also got similar suspicious emails, could you take a look? And then kind of built out and expanded that relationship. And some of the other authors have been, you know, working for quite a while now on the Syria angle. So it's kind of, you know, ad hoc in terms of those countries. As for Saudi Arabia and Egypt, I definitely, I think those are countries that all of the authors are really interested in. Just in terms of, it's difficult to, when you're taking a look at a country like Egypt or Saudi Arabia, to know who the targets are kind of a priori. Fortunately, we kind of, you know, it just sort of happened that in Bahrain it was activists who were being targeted, and then people in the UAE reached out to me. But if you were to take a country like Egypt and, you know, look at the various different political groups there and try to ask yourself, well, who's targeted? Who do I need to be in touch with, and who's not, like, who should I not be in touch with? Like, maybe it's the case that mainstream activists aren't targeted to a large degree. Maybe it's the Muslim Brotherhood that's being targeted. Maybe it's other groups. So it's really difficult to know who you should get in touch with. And in some cases, like, for example, like, take the example of the Muslim Brotherhood. Egypt considers that a terrorist organization. And, you know, the UK and US don't, but it seems like there might be some ethical considerations about, you know, providing support to an organization like that. So there's lots of complex factors you've got to juggle in your mind, and, you know, the hardest thing I'd say is just identifying the targeted group. Sometimes you can do this if you find like a sample of this spyware or an indications of government attack just somewhere in the wild. And if you can look at and analyze the bait content and see who you think it might be targeted against, that might be a good way to get in and break into one of these new countries. But the short answer is yes, I definitely have ambitions to look at the broader Middle East and world.
For Saudi, do you think it would be the most challenging? Would people, you think, be afraid to reach out to you? Just because it's very stable there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's countries like Saudi and the UAE are quite similar in that there's really, like, the people who are kind of opposing the government are very much in the minority in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And it's more challenging there because there's not really this infrastructure and architecture of civil society which people can kind of fall back on and use to facilitate connections and work there. So, like, if you take a country like the UAE, there's pretty much not really, you know, any robust civil society there, or Saudi Arabia similarly has a deficit in that area. I think, you know, my impression is that people in Saudi Arabia would probably be a bit more careful and reluctant because countries like Saudi and the UAE are not really that much as well in the media spotlight. So if someone gets killed in Saudi Arabia, you know, you really don't hear about it. Like, you know, around, you know, there's been a couple dozen people who've been killed in Saudi Arabia in protests since 2011. I'm sure almost none of you have heard of that. So there's definitely a risk in these countries which don't have the civil society and don't really have you know, robust media coverage that will actually, like, nobody will notice if something bad happens, really.
Thank you.
Okay. Is that one final question? Okay, before the final question, I had an email, I don't know if it's legitimate, from someone named Kevin Fu. It said all students should be at the registration desk at 3:30 for a photograph. On the other hand, I've also received information from others that there may be a bombing there, some kind of Peter Honeyman photo bombing. So students, 3:30 at the registration desk at your own risk. And our final question.
Could you comment, any one of you, on the how interdisciplinary your teams are? Do you, for example, have anthropologists or social scientists working with you?
Well, we have technical people and social science people. It is very interdisciplinary. It's actually surprising at this point that we have a number of technical people, just because we need it to keep up with the number of samples that we're getting these days. But it is very much a mix. And the context of the social science side is very important to understand what's going on and actually have an idea of what the threat models are and what's happening and where we should be looking.
So in our case, it's purely technical people and researchers, and we had to do a little bit of homework to find out how to get in touch with people who might be able to help us with the data.
Great. Well, thank you all for coming. Let's thank our speakers/panelists one more time.